Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. Hi, this is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence Development Corporate. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. Well, in our last episode, I began a discussion with Dr. David Hilson from the UK regarding risks and risk attitudes. Well, in this episode, David and I continue that conversation with a focus on how we can help our organization take the next step in implementing risk management practices. Let's pick up that interview midway into the discussion.
You know, most project managers and leaders, I think they would agree that, you know, everything we're talking about here, David, this whole managing risk, this is a good thing. You know, it's a good thing. Yet how often do you hear people, you know, enthusiastically say, we can't wait for this risk identification meeting. Wow.
I wish.
Yeah. Maybe when the risk doctor shows up. But, you know, this lack of enthusiasm could lead to lack of commitment. So any recommendations for someone who's listening who they want to take steps towards more proactively managing risk, but they face teams who see it at best as a necessary evil?
Well, I think there's a whole range of strategies that we can deploy to get risk management working, and there's no one silver bullet which works for everybody. Yeah. So I would recommend a range of different interventions to say, let's try several of these things to encourage people to do it. So the first thing you could try is just to mandate it. It's not an option. We just have to do this. Yeah. And you'll be in trouble if you don't do it. We won't have our project approved if we don't have a proper risk register, if we don't have a decent risk assessment. We can't get the budget out. We won't get on to the next phase. It's got to be done. Now, mandating works in some cultures and not in others. You know, some people react against it. So it's part of the story, but not the whole thing. So here's a second thing. Demonstrate the benefits. Show that it works. Let's record the fact that we identified this potential threat. We put these actions in place and it didn't happen. Or we identified an opportunity, we implemented these responses, we got some benefits, we saved some time. Let's actually do our post-project reviews, our lessons learned exercises, and identify where the bad things went away and the good things came in because of the risk process. A third thing, we need to use the results. We can't just have a risk register that goes on the shelf and is ignored until the next review next month.
Right.
We've got to say, oh, these are the top risks. In that case, I change my project strategy like this. In that case, I rearrange my project resources and put the best people on these tasks. In that case, I talk to the customer here about how to change our project scope or how to reprioritize our work.
Yeah.
If you don't use the results, then why would you bother?
Right.
And there's a whole range of other things like that. So telling people, mandating it, pushing it, pulling it by saying, yeah, we've got to do this, but also it's useful. I'm going to actually use these results to determine my strategy, and demonstrating the benefits. This is really going to save you time. This is going to make your job easier. Why wouldn't you want to do it?
Right. You know, that's really good insight, because I suppose I can think back where I have mandated it before, but more often though, maybe there wasn't enthusiasm coming into the meeting afterwards. I have found that these processes can move it from we're feeling like victims or worried about things to we're actually doing something about it. And people on our teams are worried. And so we can show that there's even that, like you said, not just this conscious benefit, but there's also it can help us on the emotional level of, all right, my boss gets it. He knows this is an issue and we're doing something about it. And so there's benefits not just organizationally, but even emotionally.
And it helps to depersonalize some of these things. You know,
yeah.
If you go to your boss and you say, I'm really worried because I don't know how this is going to work out. You know, we've got a technical solution to develop. I don't really know how to do it or how long it will take, which is the kind of uncertainties we're talking about. You know, you could get slapped down pretty hard and say, well, you're the expert. Go and do it. You know,
right.
Don't bring me problems. Bring me solutions.
Right.
Now here we're actually putting these things on the table as project risks, which we need to address through a process. It's not my fault. You know, I'm doing the good thing by putting it on the table so we can develop a solution and get, you know, deal with it.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really important here is the opportunity side. Don't forget, we're going to be looking for ways to make your job easier,
right.
To save time, save money, to enhance performance, work faster, smarter, cheaper. And that's a big motivation. And I think another thing that's important for us as project managers is we have to do this stuff ourselves. Mm-hmm. We actually have to manage our own risks, not just tell other people to do it. And as they see us doing it and we're modeling what good risk management looks like, yeah. then they'll know how they should be doing it in their part of the project.
Yeah, yeah, well said. You know, I'm intrigued by the impact of what you refer to as the precautionary principle. I had never heard of that until you're reading more of what you've written, whether it's in projects or just society overall. And my understanding of the principle is that, you know, we need to take some protective action in situations where the threat is so big and we can't prove that harm would not result. And so this can cause us to respond in a way that appears to be overreacting. I can think of people saying now about Y2K, oh, we overreacted, or maybe the Iceland volcano more recently, or the spread of swine flu. But the thing is, when proof is available, we know whether our plans were appropriate or not. Yet until we have that data, we risk either over or under reacting. So how do you help teams and organizations sort through this and, you know, maybe not go too far in the precautionary principle, but develop more considered responses?
Yes, that's really difficult, actually. I mean, the proverb that people use is better safe than sorry. And really, the precautionary principle occurs a lot in the political world, where we expect our governments and our masters to protect us from all the bad things in the world that might happen. Right. And if they don't protect us, if swine flu comes through and it kills a lot of people, then they're in trouble. Now, I'm not sure that's appropriate. You know, that stuff happens and you can't protect yourself from everything. The important thing is to know what level of risk is acceptable. And we had a thing in the UK with swine flu last year when it was first came onto the into the public consciousness. There was a newspaper headline that said swine flu, 100,000 children will die. Now, that was the extreme tail of the prediction. It was the maximum that could possibly happen in the worst of all possible worlds. 100,000 children in Britain could die. It's not that they will die, but it's that it could happen. So now, do we protect ourselves against that level of impact? We ordered millions of pounds worth of vaccination for everybody in the country to have 6 doses of swine flu vaccine. To have a course. And you know what? 3 months ago, we threw it all away because we didn't use it, because we didn't need it. They wasted all that money and then they got criticized. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have those kind of big decisions in projects, but we still have the better safe than sorry kind of attitude. How do we choose an appropriate level of risk? We're back really to this risk attitude question. You know, should I be careful or can I take a chance here? Yeah. And the problem is you never know beforehand.
Right.
You can take lots of protective action and the thing never happens.
Yeah.
Well, did you make it go away or was it never going to happen anyway? You know, there's no real way of knowing apart from the post-project review, the post-project lessons learned. Mm-hmm. As you said, when we have the data afterwards, we know whether we were right or wrong. Now, we need to learn that lesson from previous projects and take that forward into the next project. And if we say, you know, we tried to protect ourselves from that threat on the last 10 projects and it never happened.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we don't need to worry about it this time. You know, maybe it never was a risk. Mm. Or if we say we tried that response and we're very glad we did, well, let's build that into our project strategy next time. It's a very tough decision, a very tough call, but I think the only way to move forward on it is that kind of learning, that knowledge management from one project to the next, so we grow our experience base.
Yeah.
And that's the real way to deal with it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I can think of a organization here in the Chicago area where I'm from, that they have an R&D group, which my experience with them is they're highly risk averse. And if you think of R&D and risk averse, that could very well mean that you end up stunting the growth of your company by being too safe than sorry and not investing appropriately. So this can be not only personally, it could be organizationally where we err on that side.
You see, you're back to the opportunity piece.
Yes.
And what we need to do in R&D is we need to take a chance in order to find those opportunities and exploit them to the maximum. But if we play it safe and we say, oh, it's a nasty world out there, things could go horribly wrong, I won't even play the game, then you're denying yourself those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So you're right, especially in innovation, in R&D, in those kind of fast-moving projects, we've got to be out there and saying, well, let's take a chance with this one, but we do it with our eyes open. We do it with a robust risk process in place. We do it with responses here, with risk mature people. We're watching the risk. We're not going to do anything that would crash the business or would, you know, have a major significant impact, but we are going to take a chance.
Yeah.
So you take risks with your eyes open. You take risk intelligently. That's the key.
Yeah, I like that. You know, David, something I've noticed with myself as well as experts I interview on this podcast, it's easy for us to give advice, but it can be challenging sometimes in practicing what we preach, so to speak. So of all the advice you share in your writing and teaching on risk, what's most difficult for you personally to follow when you're faced with ambiguity?
No. I do all this stuff all the time.
I'm sure.
Well, you know, that was a difficult question to address. And I saw it. You gave me very kindly the sight of the questions beforehand. And yes. So I took this one to my wife. I said, okay, what do you see where I'm not practicing what I preach? And, you know, we do a lot of this stuff. We've learned in my family how to make it intuitive. My daughter was married in October, and we looked at the threats and the opportunities for the wedding. We
didn't have the husband, the wife.
Well, is it? Yeah. No, he's great. I love him a lot. Okay. But we looked at the things that could go wrong, and we looked at the opportunities. And we didn't have a big risk register or a Monte Carlo simulation.
Right.
We just thought intuitively about where are the uncertainties that matter, and we made sure we dealt with them. So we have embodied a lot of this just into our natural practice and behavior. But I think the one thing that my wife thinks is perhaps a weakness is, for me, a tendency to overanalyze.
Ah.
Just to think one step too far. And the danger there, you know, in your personal life and in your projects is you lose spontaneity. You lose the opportunity to have fun because you're thinking, what if this and what if that? And so for me, I think the question is, when do I stop doing the risk analysis and get on with life?
Yeah.
And I think it's also a lesson for our projects. You could analyze risk to death. You could have risk workshops that lasted for weeks and you'd never do any real work. So it's a question of saying, okay, we've got a good view. We've got the big risks out. We know what we're going to do to minimize the threats, maximize the opportunity. Now let's get on and do it. And then, of course, come back sometime later, maybe a week or a month later, and say, how are we getting on and what's changed? But my problem is a little bit of overanalysis. I need to just get on with it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd have to say, on my personal basis, as you shared your transparency there, I would have to say I totally buy into the concepts. But when I face ambiguity on a personal side or on my personal projects and there's a lot of pressure on it, I'll often want to jump to the fix right away. And so if I identify some, let's go fix it right away. It's almost like coming up with the identification and jumping straight to the response instead of doing some sort of ranking on them. And so that can end up either wasting time or putting focus on the things I really don't need to put the focus on.
That's why in the risk process, we have identification, then assessment or analysis,
exactly.
And then response planning.
Yeah.
Because you could jump straight to response planning, but you might be wasting your time on a small risk that you need to deal with.
Absolutely.
But then there's some bigger risk that you've used all your energy and resources on dealing with the small ones and you miss the big one. So assessment doesn't need to be a big deal, but we do need to rank those things and make sure we deal with the big ones first.
Yeah. You know, I'm assuming that there are a lot of people listening to us, David, are saying, you know, this is intriguing. I've got to learn more. If you had to make a recommendation of one book for people to start with out of what you've written, if they were just to start with one and then follow a progression, what would be the first one you'd recommend they read?
Well, it depends if they're coming from the project world or the more general business world.
Okay.
So more generally, the book I just issued a couple of months ago in November 2010, Exploiting Future Uncertainty. I would start with that if you want a general view of risk.
Mm-hmm.
What it has is about 60 short sections. Each one contains tips and hints on one specific focus area in risk management. So you can read just an individual section or you can read a whole theme, which gives you quick tips on the things that really matter. If you want to look at risk in projects, then I have a book called Managing Risk in Projects.
Okay.
It's very short. It has 7 very short chapters, again, very focused, but it kind of distills a whole lot of wisdom and insights into a very short space.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those books are not expensive. They're quite easy to read, lots of illustrations and stories, but with real tips that you can practically use. So Exploiting Future Uncertainty for the general business reader, Managing Risk in Projects for people in the project management world.
I appreciate those recommendations. For those listening, I recommend you check out those two books. Start there. I put links to his website as well as to these two books in the show notes for this cast. David, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you again for joining us on the People and Projects podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Andy.
Once again, please make sure to check out the links in the show notes for David's books and website. And by the way, the new book that David mentions regarding failures in society, it's now available for purchase. A link to get a copy for that book is also in the show notes. Hey, there's still time to get the free premium podcast subscription and e-learning by signing up for the Leadership Fast Track program by May 1st, 2011. Contact me with any questions. I would love to have you in the program. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of the People and Projects podcast. Have yourself a great week.
Man, what's the next challenge for you on the horizon? You've accomplished so much.
My next thing is looking at failure in society. And my next book is called The Failure Files, looking at why people fail why societies fail, and trying to pick up on some of these ideas from the global recession and other things.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to broaden out a little bit wider. And then I want to talk about risks in parenting. That's my project for next year.
Very, very good. Oh, both of those sound very intriguing and actually very well timed.
But it's been a great opportunity, and I've enjoyed talking to you about it. So thank you for making that possible. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And have yourself a great 2011.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, bye-bye for now.